Hey, thanks. When I got this email, the organizers asked me to talk about, host the discussion on the foundations of quantum mechanics. I was like, oh no, this will be a disaster. I'm sitting there trying to plan it, and I just corral one of those discussions is generally very hard. So what I'm going to do is instead I'm going to kind of motivate one of the key questions that I'm interested in. And then I'm going to try to really respond well as I can to questions and not try to suppress them. So hopefully that's the direction the questions will come from. Unlike most fields, quantum foundations is kind of defined by what the practitioners disagree on rather than what they agree on. So hopefully by kind of staying on this one path, we will keep it a little bit aligned. Okay, my first question, and again, there's going to be some questions where I really want people to respond, is what do people think Newton's most important contribution is, or was? this is a totally serious question.
Unifying physics into simple laws.
Okay. Any other alternates?
Deterministic mathematical equations.
Calculus.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously he did a lot of great things. These are getting towards what I'm going to say. I just want to introduce, I'm not going to make a claim on what he did that was most important, but these are getting, I was actually expecting somebody to say F equals MA, and I'm glad people went more fundamental than that. Eugene Wigner, in his Nobel speech, right? So what he said was the most important thing that Newton did was the distinction between initial conditions and dynamical laws, right? So I'm going to do a quick quote. The sharp distinction between initial conditions and laws of nature was initiated by Newton, and I consider this to be one of his most important, if not the most important, accomplishments. Before Newton, there was no sharp separation between the two concepts. Kepler, to whom we owe the three precise laws of planetary motion, tried to explain also the size of the planetary orbits and their periods. After Newton's time, the sharp separation of initial conditions and laws of nature was taken for granted and rarely even mentioned. When you think a priori, if you're Kepler or you're one of his contemporaries sitting up there looking at the sky and watching the planets go around, it is not so obvious which of the data that you need to explain and which that we're allowed to just kind of put to the side and say that these are accidents of history. If you're just looking at where is the planet in the sky at all these different times. I think it is reasonable to think that may be Newton's biggest accomplishment.
And do you know what Newton himself regarded his biggest accomplishment?
it's probably something about the
Bible.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, new interpretation of the Bible. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let that be a lesson to all of
us. So the really basic picture here is we're just going to think about. Of course, I guess you wouldn't have thought about it in terms of a Hamiltonian, but we're going to update it. Okay, so this part is the unexplained part. This part's the theory. And this part's the explained part. Okay, so another way you could think about this is just that classical mechanics is sort of a compression algorithm. You've got all of this data that you're looking in and you're taking in. The theory is going to let you take that big blob of data and compress it down until the uncompressible part, the part that doesn't seemingly have any structure, and that's what you're allowed to start with. And when you get to this part, you're done, right? You've explained everything, at least as far as physics is concerned. There's a good interview online where Richard Feynman's talking to Fred Hoyle, and they ask him, you know, what today do you think is considered part of physics, which may ultimately, that's not part of physics today, which may ultimately be part of physics. And he says, at the present moment, most people consider that we study the laws of physics given a certain condition, but how did they get into that condition? He goes on to discuss that. That right now those are kind of considered part of history of orbital mechanics or these kind of things, but of course you can go all the way back to the beginning and start thinking about cosmology and pulling that in to what people do. And in fact, this is to some extent what people do, right? Cosmologists are looking at things, you know, inflation for coming up with a nice, simple initial state of the universe, maybe, or the no-boundary wave function for the gravitational components. And so the picture here is that you have nothing unexplained. Okay. Recently, Steve Weinberg wrote an article in the New York Review of Books, where he came out as somebody who was, you know, well, not came out, he had been talking about this before, but he articulated his reasons for being bothered by quantum mechanics. And he says, many physicists came to think that the reaction of Einstein and Feynman and others to the unfamiliar aspects of quantum mechanics had been overblown. This used to be my view. After all, Newton's theories, too, had been unpalatable to many of his contemporaries. Evidently, it is a mistake to demand too strictly that new physical theories should fit some preconceived philosophical standard. Even so, I'm not as sure as I once was about the future of quantum mechanics. It is a bad sign that those physicists today who are most comfortable with quantum mechanics do not agree with one another about what it all means. So, in my head, this is how I think of it. Right, so when we move to quantum mechanics, and we just consider ourselves kind of an instrumentalist view, we suddenly have a lot more on this left-hand side. Okay. And I think it really is like at this level of, the fundamental ways about how we think about the world, right, that when we move to quantum mechanics, we really are doing something different, that it's this fundamentally different in the same way that pre-Newton and post-Newton was fundamentally different. And you can think, of course, back to the kind of canonical Dirac postulates that Wojciech listed the other day.
What does T mes and pi mean?
Oh, sorry. Obviously. So this is the initial state of whatever system you're looking at. T is some sort of whatever the time of the measurement that you're performing, and pi is just the projectors that correspond to the measurement you're doing. Actually, I'll talk later about why this is a better than thinking about it in terms of whatever observable you're measuring. But you can just think about this right as the eigenbasis of the observable that you're measuring. Okay, now, a lot of people say that decoherence theory at least partially resolves the measurement problem. Not everybody, but that is something that is popular to think, at least. I don't think it's easy to capture in one sentence, but if you had to say it quickly, what would you guys say about what decoherence tells us about what measurement, or what, how it partially or fully resolves the measurement problem?
It explains why there aren't quantum superpositions in a system that's entangled with stuff that you don't know about.
Okay. Any other versions?
It explains why if you have a consistent view of what a system is, then this view has to be classical. If you have a multiplicity of records, works with the coherence.
This is hard to actually try to listen to people, what people say, and respond to it. So it explains why some systems behave classically, or you can treat them as classical, maybe, right? Would anybody think that it does much to change this picture? If you were to accept that picture, how would it change that picture?
I mean, it's formulated in that picture, so it fits right in.
Well, let me see if you disagree with this. So, in terms of how people practice it, the claim I make is that what it does is it, instead of sticking these guys in, right? These are the results of decoherence theory in some sense. What instead? Actually, let me. Okay, so instead of looking at the system, we kind of pull our Heisenberg cutback one. We include at least the immediate environment. And the idea is that the thing that I'm going to claim, that we're sticking in, is this distinction between system and environment. That of the whole world, that we're going to say that the system is important to be distinguished from the environment out of all the tensor products we could choose. And that sometimes, under certain conditions, this is the stuff that we get out of the theory. Okay, so we get the basis that the thing is going to be measured in. We get the time approximately on which that it becomes diagonal in that basis and relatively stable in that basis. And then the probabilities.
I have a comment.
Yeah.
For you to jump from a Schrödinger equation description, your H there, to what happens with an environment is a huge jump. And for example, when you talked about the classical system, you did not talk about thermodynamics and how you get irreversible behavior out of reversible dynamics. And if you're going to skip classical irreversibility, then when you add in whatever you're doing with your environment and quantum mechanics, you've skipped this whole big concept of classical mechanics that's going to help you understand what's going on with quantum mechanics. I think there should be a parallelism here. Here, to irreversibility here, and here to what happens to the environment.
Right. So here we have a, or either one of these, we can certainly derive irreversibility.
So you should be able to derive irreversibility and all the strangeness of quantum mechanics by putting in the environment just like you did with classical.
So you can do it, and it's actually easier in quantum mechanics.
No, I think it's harder, but the analogy is deep.
So I had a feeling, we derailed the discussion and went into it. But as long as the environment is big and the system evolves in a way which is classically corresponds, for example, to chaotic system, you would end up having entropy production at the rate given essentially by Kolmogorov, Sinai, which means Boltzmann, right? So a lot of that stuff falls out of decoherence formalism. But I don't want to, right?
So I'm sorry, I don't want to derail.
No.
But I think the important point that you are making is that in some sense there are two classical theories which didn't talk to each other.
Yeah.
One of them is Newton.
Yeah.
And the other of them is thermodynamics.
Yeah.
And the quarrel came to you know, heated point at sort of Maxwell's demons situation, right? And I think quantum mechanics helps, but I think
I think a similar kind of connection has to be made.
So some of it has been made.
I agree.
Right. So my claim is. Not that you can't tell that story in this picture, My claim is that you don't need to tell that story in this picture. And because when we go from here to here, we're going from there's some sort of external world that's out there to we're just using this kind of this instrumentalist approach. Right? And it's only once you have reduced your ambitions to be derisive to an instrumental approach that you have to bring in all of those tools, I think.
There is another way that I'm tempted to kind of throw in here, which is, you know, with big accomplishment of Newton, separate initial conditions from evolution equations. And I think quantum mechanics, as we practice it, messes that up. Because each time you do a measurement, you reset initial conditions to what the outcome of the measurement was. Now, you know, that's just one way of thinking about it, and it doesn't clash at all with what you said. I think there is a way of thinking about it.
But already Feynman had messed that up, right?
So, I'll tell you that I'm trying to get back to here, or at least as close as we can to here, as close as is possible. And the idea being that this story will end up in this part, the third, okay? One problem you might have with this story is that what these systems are is not so fundamental, not fundamental in the same way that the kind of microscopic degrees of freedom are fundamental or thought to be fundamental. Systems are fuzzy and ephemeral and subjective. If you're talking about macroscopic objects and why they're not entangled, or why you can consider your measuring apparatus a macroscopic object. Well, the measuring apparatus is made out of particles. In the past, the particles were dispersed. At some point, they came together. Later in the future, they'll be dispersed. When that happens is not so clear. So the final quote is from Wojciech, and I've never been able to ascertain, despite several years with him, whether Wojciech is an instrumentalist or not. But I think at least Wojciech in 1998 was at least open to not being an instrumentalist.
Isn't it clear he's more of a vocalist?
Yeah. So this is the last quote. I won't do any more of this quoting stuff after this. One issue which has been taken for granted is looming large as a foundation of the whole decoherence program is the question of what the systems, which play such a crucial role in all the discussion of the emerging classicality, are. This issue was raised earlier, but the progress to date has been slow. So in some sense, what you can think about is that I want to get rid of the thing on this side that involves this unexplained system environment distinction or unspecified system environment distinction. And I'd like to go to something like this. Right. So B is just going to be some set that changes with time that enumerates the members of this set.
So are these labels or are these quantum objects or do we know?
I is a label. Discrete or continuous label.
Is that always what? For a function of the full state of the full universe or just
Yeah, the state of the full universe. So instead of the idea is that instead of being in this instrumental approach where we're just considering the systems in front of us, to get to something where we have, this can be the wave function of the universe, or it can be as large as it needs to be for our purposes, and that we get this decomposition out of it. Okay. And of course, the picture you can have of this is some psi evolving along. Where each level on the tree sums up to just the pure state evolving along, and each guy within a level is orthogonal to everyone else on that level.
So just for clarification, if I think of psi really as the state of the whole universe, as you suggest, how should I then think of T, the time? Some global.
One of the things we would want in a complete solution to this is that although this would be some time, some particular choice of Cauchy surfaces or whatever, you would be able to do it in different different choices, and that there would be some sort of covariance, that there would be a multiple descriptions that would be different in terms of how you write the map down, but they would all be equivalent to each other, describe the same going on.
But that sounds you still, in each of these branches, you would want to tag a point that identifies some absolute time to that point, even though you have all the sorts of different geometries.
I'm going to say a little bit at the end about why you might be interested in this. For gravity reasons. Right now, I'm mostly just going to stick to ignoring gravity or assuming it's just perturbative and I can choose some sort of Cauchy surface.
But even non-dynamically, you have these branches. You cast this already in the sort of context of cosmology, right?
Sure.
So we do have some, presumably the psis have different options of what cosmology would end up being.
Yeah, although I think just like you can choose different time slicings, right? You can choose to think about it as like advancing time or as like a density perturbation, but you just expect that as you move back and forth between those choices of gauge that the different pictures would all be compatible with each other. Is there something that you think would be incompatible or not able to do
that? Well, it's just how do each of the psis, each of these branches, know about that choice and all the other ones? It sounds like your TC, for example, has to be something that correlates what the corresponding Cauchy slice would have been in all of these different branches.
Yeah, and I could stick in the other spatial degrees of freedom in here. But this is just one choice of parameterization. Can I not just choose one T to parameterize things with?
And get the same result? I mean, are you claiming that if you choose any Cauchy slices in any of these psis, assuming they all have some spatial space-time geometry associated with them,
yeah,
that there's a way to...
I see what you're saying.
It doesn't matter how you choose.
No, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I think perturbatively I don't have a problem matching these up, right? I think you can just correct me on this. I think it's true that perturbatively you will always be able to identify the two different descriptions, right? There will be no ambiguity. That I can treat this as, I can treat gravity as another field. So as long as we're in that regime where I can go back and forth between saying there's a flat space-time background that's just handed down unexplained, and then gravity is just some field that's propagating around on it.
Oh, yeah, okay, fine. If you have everything is flat space-time all along,
right,
then you've given up on doing cosmology. Branching of the wave functions, but then, the issue would seem to be much less severe.
I still think you can describe branches in small perturbations. So you take just a smooth background against which you're perturbing, and then you can treat that gravitational field on it as something that can have fluctuations, and that on different branches it will be have different, the metric will have different values.
Okay. Well, maybe this is derailing it too much, so maybe we can come back to it later. But the claim wasn't that if you had all these branches, different space times, that there would have been a TC that would have, or you know, TA, TB, TC that would have related all of them together.
The claim is that you can give such a description. I think I'm doing a bad job answering your question, so we'll probably just take it offline. But the claim is that you can give, there are multiple alternate descriptions you can give, and they'll all be compatible with each other, but none one will be preferred. Okay. Steve, do you have a question?
Well, yeah, so you seem to be assuming a fair amount of additional structure beyond just a generic Hamiltonian here. Are you going to explain what structure is that you're assuming here?
What sort of structure are you talking about?
Well, to give this, specify this growing tree,
yeah,
instead of the different branches, et cetera,
yeah,
you're obviously going to have to input some more information.
Oh, yeah, that's why.
And something here.
Yeah, I'm just trying to tell you what I want, basically.
Okay,
yeah.
And then you're going to try to tell us what my...
Right, yeah, the point was to try to say that this is something to want, and it's different than what we normally do in physics. It's something that you want that is the level of, you know, people would have disagreement about of you know, instrumental approaches or whether you should divide things into initial conditions and dynamical laws. But I haven't explained at all how I would get that structure. If you want, you can think about these equivalently as just a preferred set of observables, which is just the observables that take these states as eigenstates. Okay, so I just want, or I would like to have something that explains basically the menu of options that we get in the same way that when we do a measurement in the lab, we use our physical intuition about the device. We look at it, we build a model of it in order to try to get what the different options are going to be. I would like to have that for the universe as a whole. What are the options that actually take place?
As an experimentalist, I want to understand the claim that I write my Hamiltonians down based on intuition.
Yeah.
I don't believe that.
Okay.
Can you explain what you mean?
And that would never happen in an exam.
No, seriously, I actually don't understand what you mean by that.
Right. So, when you when you move the Heisenberg cut back, right, so you go from the system to the apparatus that's larger to the environment that is larger still, you are never actually modeling all that stuff in detail. There's some level at which you can model it, and there's at some point where you just have to say, I think it roughly behaves in this area. I think if I can see it's... make this claim better.
So I think normally the way that I would do this in practice, if I have some quantum device in the lab, is that I would work very hard to get part of this. So I have some big optics table or some big cryostat in the lab, and somewhere in there I've carefully engineered some degree of freedom, some mode, to not couple to anything except for one, maybe a measurement device that I want. And because I did that, I expect my mode to behave quantum mechanically, specifically because it's not coupled to very much. And I can maybe turn the coupling to my measurement device on and off. So I think what you're calling a Heisenberg cut, and I'm sorry, I don't know that phrase, but I think I draw the Heisenberg cut around the thing that I know is not coupled to anything. And I write the Hamiltonian for that thing down based on compatibility with previous results or, you know.
Good.
General look.
Good. So if we were in a lab and we Maybe this is just a matter of this idea that although we use the instrumental approach on a day-to-day basis, which will naturally will have to match up the physical objects we see with a thing in our math. The difference is that in quantum mechanics we always do this, whereas in classical mechanics we can give a description that doesn't require this. So just in a classical universe, if I'm an experimentalist walking around, of course, if I have a model that includes everything and includes me walking around the lab, I have to use my intuition in some sense to map the part of that model that's me to my sort of observations that I'm actually making in real life, right? And the part that's the experiment. The difference with classical mechanics is that I can do that to confirm experiments, which we always have to do. The only thing we have direct access to is our observations. But I can also give a description where that never comes into play. And that's all I want, is a description of the outcomes where I never have to talk about what sort of experiment is run or where I think I am in this universe. Now, to match it up to my actual observations, I will have to do that.
Okay.
Okay.
Fine. Okay. So you're saying that the intuition comes in where I want to match up my experience to my model, and I decide somewhere to just draw a line and say, this is a measurement, and I...
Yes.
Okay. I think I understand.
Okay, and so just to be clear, I'm not going to try to going after this is not going to be something where we're going to try to derive the Born rule or anything like that. That's just going to be a separate problem. And again, this is ultimately about something that it's just a question of what physics should explain or when we can say that we're done. And just like I think it's plausible to say that, you know, just understanding the dynamical laws is good, understanding the dynamical laws and the initial conditions is better. I think that we should want this branch structure as just an additional thing that we can explain.
It will be predicated on initial conditions, right? Eventually.
Yeah. So I'm going to leave this problem. In principle, we can bring this to here as well, but I'm not going to try to attempt to solve this problem. So, one worry or objection you could have is that really what you're doing here is that these are these are just sort of the coarse grain things that we can see. You know, these are going to refer to perhaps of some sort of macroscopic quasi-classical variables. But the actual way, exact way in which we break this up is going to be dependent on maybe what's convenient to you as an observer. And that we shouldn't expect to be able to find anything objective. And I'm not saying that you might say all I need is an instrumentalist approach. You can always make that objection. What I'm saying is that you might say there shouldn't be any structure there to find. Okay? And so the one thing that I think is a good caution for that sort of thinking is just the Kolmogorov-Sinai entry. Right? And so the idea here is that you have some classical dynamical system. So this is phase space. And there's some Hamiltonian flow on it. And of course, in order to have this sort of divergence in one plane, I need to have convergence in another plane. But I can't draw all those planes, or I can't draw all those dimensions. But if you looked at just phase space, some high-dimensional phase space for a system, it's very tempting to say, well, if I'm talking about kind of what are my options, the different ways I might coarse-grain this, it seems like that's obviously going to be something that's totally dependent on the observer. And if you ask for a full coarse-graining, that is true, or it might be true. But the surprising result out of the Kolmogorov-Sinai entropy is that if you're just given the dynamical system, you can get a entropy generation rate that is not dependent on your choice of coarse graining. What it really just depends on, the crucial ingredient, is just phase space smoothness. Okay. And going along those lines, I'm going to say that we're not going to be trying to find a particular partitioning of the world, but we are going to try to be finding a particular way that the trajectories are separate. The analogy is not going to be perfect. It's that if somebody asked you, looking at classical phase space, to get a rate of branching, say, or a rate at which uncertainty is generated, it would seem to depend on your particular choice of coarse graining. And the surprising thing about the KS entropy is that you basically take it as a limit of all possible coarse grainings as they get like finer and finer. And the key ingredient is just that the reasonable coarse grainings are ones that are smooth in phase space. They're not infinitely spiky in this sort of thing. And so I think this is a direction we should go, that we should, again, that is not an exact analogy, but it is a similar thing that I'm going to say that we should look for just taking just things like spatial locality as a way to find an objective notion of branching or an objective generation of uncertainty.
Where you want to sort of cast it in some more of a continuum language instead of discrete branching.
Nope, I'm not even, I'm going to be mostly sticking discrete today. This is, again, just kind of just motivation. This would be hard. Okay. So I'm going to give you kind of one approach that you might take, the one that I think is promising. I kind of everything from the next part of this talk is just that approach. And if you don't like that approach, I think you should still care about branches. I think there's lots of things that I can say later about what branches get you. Regardless of whether you think this approach is interesting or not. Okay. Dan, what is the minimal amount of mathematical structure you'd use to define a measurement in a lab, when you're trying to model your experimental device and the sort of measurement that it makes? What's the smallest amount of information you would need to describe it? Would you describe it in terms of measuring an observable? I think you know where I'm going with this.
I don't know where you're going with this,
okay.
But normally what you do is you have some Hamiltonian of the system you care about, the thing that you went out of your way to make quantum, and some semi-classical variable that you just sort of wave your hands and say you can measure on an oscilloscope. And there's some term in the Hamiltonian where those two things are coupled, and that's good enough for everything I've ever had to do.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess I just want to see if you agree that there's an overcounting there or an additional... just an over-description in the sense that you could somewhat compress it by saying... you're not measuring the observable per se, but you're just measuring the eigenbasis of the observable. So another way to say it is, what would be the difference between measuring spin x or measuring twice spin x?
There would be, I don't think there would be a difference.
Right. Or like another one is if you're measuring position and position cubed.
Well, that's different because whether or not you can cook up a measurement that measures position cubed or not is something that you have, that you might not be able to do that.
Why wouldn't you be able to measure position cubed? Can't you always just infer it from position?
Let's do position versus position squared.
I picked position cubed because you lose the...
Yeah, okay, good.
Yeah, it's so just the positive negative thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so that was the only thing, is that... So we're gonna approach this by trying to come up with a physical model of what we mean by a measurement, and try to make it as general as possible that it could, so it can kind of cover all possible measurements. And so the claim is that measurements are not defined by observables, or rather, this would be an overcounting. The claim is that measurements are equivalent to amplification in some basis. Right? So it's this choice of projectors, and this is what I was writing down there earlier, that is really what we want. And that in particular, we're going to have our system in some initial state. And this is a oversimplification in terms of all these kinds of products that I'm going to relax in a moment. And that, so this is the state of the system. Maybe these are labeled spin up and spin down, or this is X. Okay, but we can label them however we want. The key part is that it's this evolution, it's this dynamical process. And in particular, in order, all measurements that we're going to do are going to amplify. So they're going to leave many different records in different places. Is there anybody who thinks that there's like a measurement that doesn't match up onto that? Because the idea is to take this thing that has this human focused or lab focused idea and try to figure out just treat it as a dynamical process and then find that dynamical process happening in the wave function as it evolves.
This is sort of this notion of repeatability that being discussed yesterday.
That's right. It's definitely the notion. Although I'm going to actually say that if you have a measuring the device that destroys or scrambles the thing that was measured, it's still a good measuring device, as long as it leaves these other copies.
So records should be repeatably accessible. That's sort of the criteria.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the biggest thing is I'm trying to not even to really define it in an axiomatic sense. I really want to get at people's physical intuition for what happens in a measuring device and basically see if this sorts of structure always occurs.
So if you're measuring something time-dependent, you measure whatever it is.
Yeah.
The record, I mean, to put it in that story, what would be the...
So if you're measuring something that's time-dependent, you're taking, you can approximate it as multiple measurements at different times, or you can also measure some sort of single collective observable, say its average position or something like this. But ultimately, you're going to have to make copies of that as well. This is just the fact that you can't measure a spin by encoding it in one other electron. This is never what we mean. It has to be in many different places. At the very least, you know, your equipment will be macroscopically different, so that each or small pieces of that equipment in principle could be inferred. The result of the measurement could be inferred.
Okay. But it can be microscopically different in some instant of time. That's good enough. It doesn't have to remain.
I guess what I would say that I'm just trying to reproduce the instrumentalist approach. So in every physical system where you think that the instrumentalist approach can be applied, does this occur at some later time? Yeah?
Do you want us to think about these sort of equations as a cartoon? In the sense that I can imagine that you have a redundant record on an entangled system.
Perfect. Good. Yeah. So that's exactly the thing I was saying, that this is sort of the ideal or toy version. Uh-huh. If you actually were putting these tensor products between like macroscopic distinct stuff, they're going to share all sorts of microscopic entanglement, right? And so the general form, which I think does qualify as general, we can say system, and this is A through Z. I'm going to pull this in. So this system can be destroyed if you want. And then the idea is just that there's going to be this, so there's a couple different ways to write it down. So trace over everything else. Okay, so now these being orthogonal.
So did you write I or I?
Oh, sorry, you're right. Yeah.
So this is IJ. Okay.
That's right. Yeah. So you can think about tracing over one of these systems, or you can think about looking at the density matrices when you trace over everything else.
So density matrices describe some subset of these guys.
Yeah.
When you throw out rest of things.
Well, yeah, that there will be many of these guys, and mu is one of them.
Do you really want zero, or just something small?
Yeah. So I'm going to do everything, assuming we're doing perfect measurements. Okay, so this is, let's see. So the idea is that this is one aspect or one thing you would expect to apply to every single thing we ever call a measuring device. And that it's going to apply more often than just the things that we find in labs. It's going to apply all the time in real life. But here are some other things that we might expect or want from branches. So this first one is a restatement. Okay, so again, this first one is a restatement. The second one is something that follows closely from it, which is that the coherent superposition of the branches, if you had that state in a bigger laboratory, is indistinguishable from the corresponding mixture of it using local measurements. In principle, you could always tell the difference between this state, this mixed state, and this pure state by measuring some big non-local variable. But the idea is that the effectiveness of the collapse postulate, when we apply it, rests on having this property. And we want that if we do this at multiple times, that we'll basically just get a fine graining, that the number of states in the sum will just progressively get larger and larger.
So psi ice up there are the same as psi ice up here, or are they sort of branches up there?
Sorry, up here?
No, here, yeah. As initial conditions of the system, as initial states of the system.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, these are just...
But, I mean, these sound like branches. These sound like products of these things, right?
Yeah, you're right.
Okay.
Yeah.
On the last point, I mean, would that not be inconsistent with ever reaching equilibrium?
With what?
Ever reaching any sort of equilibrium?
Yeah. So we need it to be irreversible in order to explain why the instrumental approach works for all measurements we've ever done. But when the whole world reaches thermal equilibrium, it doesn't have to keep working.
Complete description, one would have to have some idea of how you could rejoin the branches or something, right? It would not be enough.
I would not know what to do then. One way you could interpret this, right? So if you have an instrumentalist approach, it only has to work as long as there are instruments that function. Which requires, you know, have some access to some low entropy stuff. Instruments don't function properly if it's urine and heat bath. How to think about the world in some hypothetical future time when everything is thermalized, I don't really know how to think about that classically. One claim you could make from this is that it's not just that the world thermalizes and is in some sense classically thermal on large scales. A result of thinking this way is that you just can't give a classical description to what's going on. Another way to think about it is that there are kind of branches coming from left field that are constantly interfering with everything that you do, and there is no classical description of what's happening.
Isn't it sufficient if these branches just exist for a certain time during the time when we reason about? Mm-hmm. I mean, I could do an experiment on a planet that explodes after I did my measurement, and still I could have done everything I do normally. I don't care about the future of these branches.
But wouldn't you run into a problem if you say that the whole state has to be evolving unitarily and then suddenly some of your branches keep disappearing?
I mean, I don't see, because there was no requirement that the branches don't. Only can separate and cannot merge. I mean, I don't see,
so,
see that formally.
Right. So. This gets back to the Wigner's friend question, right? Which essentially boils down to, if you apply the instrumentalist approach, and there are people walking around applying this approach, they, insofar as you can put them in superpositions, you will not be able to reconcile everybody's outcome, right? And so, If you want to discuss whether that is really possible, one thing you would have to do is figure out whether those sorts of things are can be done. I think it is not so clear that those sorts of experiments are kind of are possible in the lifetime of the universe, or with kind of reasonable, even yeah, any sorts of acquirable resources. But until you have a description of what branches are, you can't even ask that question, I guess. Okay. So basically the ingredient that we're going to take is just the notion of spatial locality. So the idea here is that instead of sticking in a system environment distinction, we're going to see how far we can get by just using spatial locality. Now, I'm going to write that down here as saying I can break the world up into microscopic bits. In, let me put X here. You can't actually write down, so in a field theory, you can't actually do this. You can't think about the world as a bunch of little chunks that are all independent from each other. And I'm going to talk about this situation at the end. We probably won't have time, but I can talk about it afterwards. The only thing I would want to say about this is that if you think that there is some sort of way to take the state of a QFT and understand it in terms of measuring devices happening, the ability to ever record anything in a local device exactly is just as broken there as it is going to be here in my description. So it is not something that is new to what we're going to talk about.
So can you briefly comment on the relation between what you now are putting as an assumption to what you used before? Because before you said that we do this usual thing of separating the Hilbert space into system and environment, we make that kind of an artificial separate, or this all depends on how we make this separation.
Good.
We already at this stage have said we just take the environment to be some remote part and S to be some localized thing.
Good. So the thing there's going to be some sort of mathematical structure that has to come in. Otherwise, you just have a vector in a Hilbert space that has no structure. And so the claim is that we're making an improvement, a big improvement, by just using spatial locality rather than some specification of the environment from the system. That we would want to be able to derive approximate systems from just the dynamics and this and these notions of amplification that I was talking about.
So in gravity, things are more subtle, but just in local quantum field theory,
yep,
there's something very much like this, which is at the algebraic level, subalgebras of the algebra of observables. Is that enough for what you're going to do? Because if so, then that's as rigorous as anything in field theory.
Yeah, so ultimately, I hope to be able to get as rigorous as anything is in field theory. Just we'll make that bar. I think that.
And do you literally need a factorization of the Hilbert space, or is it good enough just to have algebras that are commuting subalgebras?
It is not good enough because I'm basically going to trace other things out. Or another way to talk about it is that I'm going to stick projectors that are localized in space, and you can't have those. We exchanged a couple of emails a while back, and this is basically the reason that I'm interested in it, is how to take the things I'm about to talk about and put them in a QFT language. And for almost everything I'm going to do, I'm not even going to use a notion of distance. So I'm just going to use this idea that we can break the world up into a lattice of things that are different, because the only thing I'm going to basically use it for, except for one step at the end, is just calling things different. Let's see what time is. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about fragments of the lattice. So at the end, none of them will be specified a priori, but I want to be able to talk about them. So that might be F. That might be F prime. Okay? And we have an obvious notion of F and F prime being disjoint and these sort of things. Good, thank you. So F bar is going to be notation to refer to everything else. Yeah. Okay, and then I'm just going to define when I say that one observable on some fragment records another observable, and everything I'm going to do here is going to be with respect to some state for the whole lattice. Okay. Exactly when okay, so it just says that for each one of these eigenprojectors that projects onto the subspace associated with this eigenvalue, I'm going to say that this observable on F records an observable on F prime when they're eigenprojectors where you can just apply this to the global state and you get out the same thing if you applied the corresponding projector to the global state on the other side. Okay, so this is basically just giving a general definition of what we were talking about before. Equivalent ways to say this are that tracing over okay, so the idea here is that I'm going to project using F prime on the global state for corresponding to some eigenvalue labeled by I. Okay, so this is inside here is a pure state of the whole system, but then I'm going to trace everything else out except F bar. So I'm basically asking, okay, conditional on some value of an observable at F prime. What is the corresponding state at F? Right, so these are two different fragments that are disjoint from each other.
F prime is inside F bar.
No, they're disjoint.
So it's inside F bar.
Oh, F prime is inside F bar, yes. Sorry, I misheard you. I misheard. Yep.
So you have a way of identifying F or the picture of F or the projections corresponding to OF in... Sorry, so these projections in F those in F prime?
Projections in F, those in F prime.
I mean, you have this notion of pi I F prime.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're right, so the idea is that, so any observable has this decomposition, right?
Sure.
And I'm just giving a definition of if you handed me two of these observables, it means handing me their corresponding projectors.
Uh-huh.
So F prime contains a record of
well, it's a symmetric relationship.
Okay.
So, F the observable at F contains a record of the observable at F prime, and vice versa. So, in fact, it's a totally symmetric relationship. So you can just extend this to a collection of them. Okay, does that make sense? And that record each other. Okay. So we can write this down as it just being this condition. Okay, and what it means is that we can just naturally define this to be the branch corresponding to that recorded observable. Okay, so the recorded observable is some sort of global thing, not associated with any one of the fragments in particular.
Just regarding the terminology, recorded sounds as it's referring to something that is stable over time, but technically the definition is just depending on the state at a certain time, so it could change arbitrarily in principle.
In principle. Well, not quite, right? So you have this Lieb-Robinson bound that is going to prevent entanglement, kind of can't just be created or destroyed over long distances. But the construction I'm going to give is all for a state at one instant of time. And again, because we're just trying to grasp towards a definition, and then the idea would be that it then becomes an open problem whether those states actually do kind of link up from one time to the next, and how stable they are. And for just, it's also natural just to call the redundancy associated with this observable just the number of fragments in it. Okay, and the thing to note, of course, is that none of this depends on the actual eigenvalues, little o, that we're using. So this is really just a statement about the entanglement structure of the big global state. It doesn't have anything to do with the actual observables. Okay, let's see. It's supposed to be an hour and a half? Yeah, that's a problem. I'm just going to, so state two of the corollaries of the thing that is shown in that starred guy. That will maybe be of interest. So the first corollary is that if you have multiple recorded observables, so say we have O1, O2, O3 on some lattice psi, or psi in some lattice, then they are mutually commuting if the R's, call it L, is strictly greater than the number of lattice sites.
The square root.
Okay? So if you have a finite lattice, and you know its size, this is not something that we want. I'm pointing towards two definitions, neither of them which are nice, or neither of which have all the properties that we want. But I do think it's interesting that if you just require some sort of large amount of redundancy compared to the size of the lattice, you automatically get a preferred basis, or not a complete basis, but something that you can extend to a basis. The other corollary, and so this is, so basically this is one way that you could try to define what you mean either by branches or about the basis that you want to coarse grain into branches. Okay? If this gave you too many states in your basis, it would still be a good starting point to reduce from there, because you would say, listen, anything that I'm going to call classical, say, has to have some sort of high redundancy, and I'm just going to look at this basis and move on from there.
So modulo square root thing, the statement of the corollary is observables which are mutually recorded are the same observable.
Up to
degeneracies and minor kind of. It's the same observable.
Well, you can make one.
Same to each other.
They have the same eigenstates, but they might be unrelated to each other. So if you make a measurement of a spin over here, and you make a measurement of something else over there, the idea is that there will be branches of the joint thing that are an eigenstate of both of those. So with the same hypothesis, but now if we assume...
So do you assume that these are binary ones, or what are they?
No.
No? It can be arbitrary large output.
Yep. And they're also mutually commuting. Okay, so the picture here is just given any preferred length scale, okay. If you just consider the set of all observables that are recorded at least three times in spheres of this size separated by that size, then they all have to be mutually commuting. Just to compare these really quick, the nice thing about this is that it doesn't know about the size of the lattice, right? The nice thing about both of these things that is maybe hopefully at least an intriguing improvement over the story that you hear a lot about with decoherence, is that you don't have to specify any sort of macroscopic systems to say this. These descriptions have all of the symmetries of the lattice, if the lattice is translationally symmetric and these sorts of things. And interestingly, the counterexample that shows that these are tight is the short code. So, in the case of 3, let's see. The short code is something that where you have, right, you can map a single qubit onto a state of the whole lattice. There are non-commuting observables that you can measure in these different places. So if you measure any, if this was just a 3x3 qubit lattice, so a 9-qubit short code, if you measure any one of these columns, you can read off sigma x. If you measure any one of the rows, you can read off sigma z. And this can be goes from 3 to any number. Okay, and so this is where this root n comes from. The fact that this is 3 comes from basically the Bell pair, being the counterexample for if it was just two. Okay, I think I better wrap it up there, which is too bad. Let me say one thing, just because this is some of the feedback that I was, or something that might catch the attention of folks. So this basically 5 more minutes. So what we're looking at is basically GHZ-like information. Okay? And, you know, you can obviously imagine the generalization of the GHZ state to summing over many different sort of outcomes, or whatever you want to call it, many different bond dimensions, and to many different sites. If you try to take a matrix product representation of this, what you find is that this GHZ information doesn't get efficiently represented. The matrix product state, the whole point is that it's a good way to represent local entanglement, but as you extend a GHZ state over very far different distances, it becomes very hard to compress, and all your bond dimensions go up to whatever this guy is. But what one can imagine is that the tensor product, or rather the branch, right, so this is, that instead what you want is a tensor structure that looks something like that for your tensor network. The claim, again, based off of physical intuition, is that this is exactly the sort of entanglement that we expect to find out there in the real world. That when you have a system that's out of equilibrium and not just perturbed, a little bit out of equilibrium, and not just out of equilibrium because there's some conserved quantities, but literally out of equilibrium for a while because it's doing interesting stuff way before it thermalizes, that you're going to generate many of these guys. And so the first one will be the first time a laboratory experiment gets run, or it'll be the first time you have a chaotic system that is exposed to radiation or anything like that, that records where it's going, and you get these kind of redundant records produced. And that as time goes on, the number of these guys that you will need to insert and to give an efficient representation of the state will increase. And this will be the last thing. The reason why you might care when you're doing the simulation is that the number of branches we expect to grow exponentially in time, just because branching events are going to be kind of distributed in both time and space. And so if we want to compute some sort of endpoint function, this sum might be really too big, that we might not be able to have a way to keep track of all these exponential number of branches. But if the redundancy on these guys, which I'll call this M to keep things from getting confusing, M point function, if the redundancy is greater than M, then we can find a projector that commutes with these. On some particular fragment, right? Because we have more than M of them, which means we can come through here and annihilate. And then we've got a nice cluster. classical probability, or a nice classical sum. Once you get to here, now in order to get a good accurate measurement of this, you only need to sample from this distribution. You don't have any sort of a sign problem. And so what it means, the idea would be that you would, instead of keeping track of all of the branches, you would just keep track of some very small random sample of them. And then, in fact, I expect that this is the only way you can really do these sorts of simulations. Nobody tends to do big, complicated non-equilibrium simulations right now. But insofar as we look around and we observe that in the real world, macroscopic systems, we can simulate them efficiently on classical systems. And we do this by just sticking in stochastic, or, you know, by sticking in random events and then choosing which path we go down randomly to sample what happens. This is, I think, going to be the way that you would simulate that if you wanted to give a full quantum description. Okay, I'm going to stop there. I'm sorry I ran over time. Yeah.
So a naive question. If you have a system that truly has a finite number of degrees of freedom and you run it forever, uh-huh. I guess your number of branches can't keep increasing
yep.
in this definition. So it goes back down or sort of saturates?
What happens? So I don't know what happens. I think, you know, this is thermalization.
Something like it, yeah. But then you might have fluctuations out of thermalization eventually, too, right?
Yeah, that's right. I expect that any definition that you'll get will only be kind of up to the accuracy with which you can come up with which you can define irreversibility, which may be something that you can only do in some sort of large n limit. So I definitely expect that the branch decomposition will become sort of more poorly and poorly defined as you thermalize. Another way you can describe it is that if you're actually doing the simulation, I expect that at the beginning it will be very numerically sort of very obvious or efficient to find the branches. There's only a few of them and there's kind of many records out there with which they're all correlated. But as there become more and more of them, there will kind of be alternative branch structures that will be equally good at compressing what is now a very hard to compress thing. As the system gets kind of explores this bigger Hilbert space, it will no longer be obvious that there's like one good way to compress it in terms of a branch decomposition.
There might be toy models of this. Well, probably it's too complicated. You need enough degrees of freedom.
I really want a toy model bad that's tractable. I haven't found one that is good enough for me to try to sink time into doing.
Just as a follow-up, would it then be true that the terminal state, the thing that is finally thermalized, is no longer compressible at all?
Yeah. So, and you know that has to be true, right?
Maxed out on whatever complexity and all that.
That's right.
Okay, I can ask one.
Yeah.
You initially started talking about the wave function branches on these Cauchy slices, but then here you switch to sort of branching events in space and time. So
So we know that has to be something like that has to be true. And this is what I was trying to get at when I was saying that the branch structure would be, you would want it to be. We don't have anything like that now. You would want it to be covariant. So you know it has to be because if you just have time and space, right? This can just be two. Each one of these can be a Stern-Gerlach apparatus, right? And if you do some sort of boost, this guy is going to go here, and this guy is going to go there, and they're now going to be in a different time order, so that in this new reference frame, you're going to have to give a different branch description. But you would want them.
Then the branch sort of as a branch, and then it's influences things in it.
Absolutely. Yeah, so it's going to be restricted by the light cone, or even in non-relativistic context. Like I said, there's this Lieb-Robinson bound, which is basically just it's a speed of sound for entanglement that comes out of the Hamiltonian that's coupling nearby sites.
But then when two of these things run into each other, how?
Nothing happens, so it becomes, so let's say we start off in this reference frame. Right, so here we just have psi, here we have some sum over psi I, and here we have a sum over I j. Right, and so, you know, if these are Stern-Gerlach apparatuses, then both I and j are going to run over 0 and or 0 and 1 or whatever, how you want to deal with them. When you do a boost, you're just going to find that instead this is going to be over j initially, but at the end, when you go to a surface that includes both of those events, then it'll, again, you'll be over a psi ij.
But don't you have to integrate over x as well? I mean, you could have branching at every point, and then each point could generate multiple branches depending on what the outcome right there was.
Right. So the branches will not in generally be discrete, but you definitely can't, there's going to be some sort of a branch density. But it will not be like a branch density at every point in space. There's kind of a general idea that if you have a bunch of degrees of freedom, they can't all be classically tracked. Right? You basically, if you're going to make a bunch of copies, you're kind of soaking up those degrees of freedom. So there can only be a small special subset of observables that are tracked. Model that you can just imagine is a bunch of spins on the line. You don't expect every spin to lead to branching in the sense that it's being measured by other guys because there'd be nowhere to stick all that information. But what you can imagine and which you can construct, at least at a given time, it's easy to just write down a wave function that has this property, where the mean magnetization in a region is is kind of a quasi-classical variable. That is recorded by the many guys together. And so you would say that the mean magnetization in this region would branch at some point. It would really follow, depending on your model, would follow some sort of random walk probably, as would the mean magnetization in this region. But it wouldn't be like at every single lattice point. Does that make sense?
Well, I got here in the middle, so. But I'll ask this question anyway. So the ordinary quasi-classical realm of everyday experience is characterized by a certain kind of coarse graining in terms of densities, conserved quantities like energy, momentum, number in various epochs. Yeah. And so we can describe a whole histories of those. Right. So my question, but Murray and I were always worried about whether there was. And the quasi-classical realm is highly predictive because the classical correlations mean that things are organized in time. And it's also simple to describe, as I just did. So Murray and I were always worried about whether there was some other set of variables that would display similar high levels of correlation in time as measured by an appropriate entropy, and similar simplicity of organization as represented by essentially the algorithmic information content. Does our everyday quasi-classical realm fit into your framework? And does your framework suggest a way of looking for these alternative quasi-classical realms?
So you can think about this, it fits into the framework. Good. And the...
My relief.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, when you're thinking about ideas to pursue, the first thing you do is say, does this reproduce what Jim has wrote down long ago? The idea is that that we're going to take spatial locality as kind of the structure around which we build everything, and we're going to demand that there are records in different spatial places.
Yeah, right, I got that.
That this will eliminate the other possible descriptions that you guys were considering. Or just another way to say it is that those other descriptions may exist depending, I'd have to think a little bit more about, I mean, this like algorithmic compression or complexity is a good way to think about it. And I have to think about, that's like a basis dependent statement a little bit. But the idea would be that those may exist, but they are not going to display correlations in space, that you can confirm things about, the average, so that insofar as you say, we're just going to take it as one of the things we observe, that this is a special property, these correlations in space, that picks out the quasi-classical realm that you and Murray-Gell-Mann have talked about.
Thank you. So if I understand correctly, most of these criteria are kind of quite global properties in some way. And I'm not sure whether this is a good or bad future, but in some way, it feels like all things that are relevant to us in physics are usually local things. So I shouldn't care whether there's also a record somewhere else on the moon or in the remote galaxy. Is this a potential conflict that could arise in this approach, that we have these global notions and want to reconcile it with our usually local way of thinking about physics?
So the first thing, right, is of course you do care if there's one record on the moon, because then it decoheres whatever you're doing locally, right?
Yes, in that sense, yes. Yeah. But then I have a local
this is the only heavy lifting that those other records are doing, is they're just picking out a preferred basis. It doesn't change what's happening locally. If you gave a unitary description of what's going on in the lab with no collapse, it doesn't affect that. It certainly doesn't change kind of the notion of, the Hamiltonian being local.
It would change the branching structure.
Good. So this will basically get to the idea that trying to think of it, to say whether it depends on the on having a good notion of irreversibility. Insofar as you produce a bunch of records after an event, a bunch of photons scatter off your equipment and they carry away information. In principle, we don't have a way to prove right now that you can't just collect all those things back together, right? If you could do that, then we would agree that there wasn't a fact of the matter about what happened in the lab in the first place, right? We're kind of saying what is the menu of options that quantum mechanics is giving us? What are the macroscopic outcomes? Insofar as you say collecting all those photons that scatter off is actually going to kind of, in some sense, retroactively change whether something happened or not happened. I think this is kind of just a feature that any branch description would have to follow.
Okay.
Thanks very much for the questions, guys. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.